Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Sarah LaDuc. Formed in the late 70s in Coventry, England, The Selector was one of the early acts to sign to Two Tone Records, home to Madness, The Beat, and The Specials. They became an integral part of the emerging ska scene, setting themselves apart from the pack by being one of the only female-fronted ska bands. Led by the fashionable and talented Pauline Black, The Selector released a number of seminal singles on Two Tone, including On My Radio, 3 Minute Hero, and Missing Words. Last night when I told you I was still about the way things are, you didn't understand the world. Much you said you did. Now I'm not the honest Joe I might seem. I can't take your life. It's late, I'm tired, your words just crackle along the while. You got a problem, baby. It's our love now. You thought you hated me. It's over. It's over. It's over. Missing words is just missing words. Missing words is just missing words. Missing words is just missing words. A couple of these songs made it on their 1980 debut LP, Too Much Pressure, which charted in the top 5 in the UK. On Halloween in 2010, Pauline Black and Arthur Gaps Hendrickson celebrated the 30th anniversary of Too Much Pressure with The Selector performing the album live at the Sinner's Day Festival in Belgium. This event kicked off the current revitalized incarnation of the legendary band, who has continued to write and release new music. Their latest record, String Theory, came out earlier this year. Pauline Black was born to an Anglo-Jewish teenage mother and a Nigerian father, and was adopted and raised by a white middle-aged couple. She wrote about her life and experience discovering her roots in Black by Design, a two-tone memoir. And Pauline Black joins us now. Pauline, welcome to the Roundtable.
Oh, hi there, Sarah, and thank you very much for having me.
Absolutely my pleasure. You studied biochemistry at university, but then, of course, have pursued this amazing music career. How did you decide to leave science and pursue music?
I guess I just didn't get fantastic grades. It was really as simple as that. And afterwards, I moved into radiography and became a radiographer for a while. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what you call those in the States, as the person who does x-rays. I mean, that's very different these days than when I was doing it. But I've always maintained a liking for science, and mixing science and art's pretty good sometimes.
And you have an amazing voice. When did you first realize you could sing?
Probably when I was about 24, 25. I came to it quite late in that respect of joining a band. I used to sing around folk clubs and things. Probably my influences way before I joined The Selector were things like Joan Armour Trading or Joni Mitchell. If you wanted to sing by yourself and write songs, they were the kind of role models you had in those days. It's very, very, very different today.
And how did you come to The Selector and learn about and start embracing and forwarding ska music?
Well, I'd always been a fan of ska music ever since I was probably around 15 years old and went to the school disco, and people were dancing to Longshot Kick the Bucket and things like this by the Pioneers. And I think just generally from there, it had always been in the back of my mind. I don't know whether your listeners remember a young lady called Millie Small who did My Boy Lollipop. And that was a huge worldwide, hit song. And I remember listening to that when I was probably about 14, 15 and thinking, I would like to sound like that. I obviously don't sound like that, but I have ended up doing that kind of music.
And as the band grew and became popular and you started touring all over, what was that experience like? Was it anything that you expected when you first joined the band?
When I first joined the band, I didn't really expect anything at all. I certainly didn't expect that it was going to be successful, and I certainly didn't expect that our first release, which was on my radio coupled with Too Much Pressure, was actually going to be a top 10 hit here and would, you know, have legs and sort of travel all over the world. And later down the line, i.e. now, people would remember us very, very much for that particular song. Also, I was pretty much thrown in at the deep end because we were part of a movement, which was the two-tone movement at the time, which had an anti-racist, anti-sexist stance. And I was the only woman, really, in it that was flying the flag for the anti-sexist stance, I guess. The rest were all young men who were in, you know, the Specials, or they were in Madness. And, of course, there was us, the Selector.
Did that, in your day-to-day, moment-to-moment life, or even professional life, you were flying the flag for women, but did it matter that you were a woman? Was anybody within the groups, within the industry, sexist toward you that you could perceive?
I think in those days, I mean, we're talking about 1979 here, just generally the whole world was sexist. I don't think it needed anybody in the industry to come along and say, this is how we're going to be towards you. The thinking was very, very different, and I think that certainly a lot of women who were, say, in my position, young black women at that time, were very much in bands which were maybe girl groups, therefore they were groomed in a certain way, and backup singers. I don't think that women's music was taken particularly seriously at all. And hence my love, I suppose, of people like Joan Armatrade, people like Joni Mitchell, who really were kind of, you know, dragging people into that sense that women were here, they had something to say, and if people decided that was a feminist thing, then so be it.
And things are very different now, I hope?
Things are very different. You can still see certain issues that I feel that maybe ladies have got to work their way through. But it's with absolute joy that I look at the charts these days, if that is a measure of success. I'm not sure how much that is or isn't.
Right.
But to see young black women as talented as people, you know, like Beyonce, even though that's not my genre of music, she is so talented that it doesn't matter what genre of music you're into, you can just say, wow, I mean, that is an empowered young lady, and may there be many, many more.
When the band broke up in the early 80s, what was the cause of that split?
The cause of the split was, as usual and always is, musical differences. We had numerous problems at that time. I mean, the two-tone movement at that time was made up of bands which were seven people in those bands. And record companies, after a while, you know, when it becomes a little more difficult to record the second album and all those kind of things. Hot on our heels was coming along the New Romantic movement, which maybe had two people in a band and a synthesizer. And I feel very much that record companies just said, hey, this is a much cheaper way to make music. These people with seven people in these bands, let's just see how it goes. And we burned very brightly, I would say, for about 2 years, the whole of the two-tone movement did. But we were a blip, if you like, between the dying days of punk towards the end of the 70s and the early 80s, which was obviously seeing the rise of the new wave and new romantic music.
Every now and then I say your name.
Every now and then you say my name.
Even though you're gone, it still remains the same.
Nothing will never change.
Pauline Black is the lead singer of The Selector. You wrote a very well-received memoir, which was published a couple of years ago, Black by Design, a two-tone memoir. How did you decide that it was time to put your sort of life story in book form and let anybody who chose to consume it and know that much about you?
It came about really because I took some time out from about 2008, I guess, to 2010. And ostensibly, really, just to take stock, think about where I was at that particular time. I think when any woman reaches her 50s, and I won't gild the lily, you know, that would have been mid-50s, that you need to start thinking about quite what it is you want to say, whether you particularly want to be involved in what you're doing anymore. Mm-hmm. And it's a little bit like you get second wind. And I was in a situation like that, and I felt that the story about mixed race people, particularly in this country, had never really been told, because there were a lot of us that got born around the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s, and we were adopted usually into white households where both parents would be white. And that, I wouldn't say that, you know, a loving family is a loving family, but it obviously causes problems a little way down the road, normally in your teen years. And I wanted to explore what those conflicts had been and how I felt, because predominantly my parents brought me up as they may have done, you know, a little white girl. They didn't really understand the background that I came from, or, you know, what my concerns might have been as I was going out into the world and really, you know, being seen as a young black woman. Nobody knows your history. You don't walk around with a placard and say, well, really, I was brought up, blah, blah, blah. You are what you are and what you bring to the table. And I feel for mixed race people, you can tend sometimes maybe to fall between two stools, and the white camp and the black camp may sort of look at you a little askance. And that has, you know, quite deep historical roots that obviously, you know, have been dealt with in the USA and have been dealt with here too. But we now live in this new world, I suppose, really, of multiculturalism. And certainly we do in the UK. And therefore there are a lot of people who are mixed race, who are living here now, who are second, third generation possibly. And I just felt like I wanted to tell that story from my point of view, obviously, and I thought that might have a resonance with people who were also experiencing that or had experienced it. And I was very pleasantly surprised by the fact that many, many people, I've done readings and things like that and talks about the book, mm-hmm. it found a lot of resonance. And that leads to a lot of quite heady discussions after readings.
You have made contact with your biological parents' families?
I've made contact with my biological mother, and we've been in correspondence, and I've been to see her at least four or five times. She lives in Australia, so she couldn't really get much further away.
Right.
And, of course, I had two siblings that she had who didn't know about my existence. But fortunately, she's a pretty feisty lady, and she took it on the chin when I turned up, and it caused a bit of a ripple through the family, obviously. It, you know, it all added to everything, and she was able then to tell me what my father's name was, and I found a huge extended family on my father's side who live in Nigeria. Unfortunately, he died the year before I found him.
Were your parents who raised you, your adoptive parents, supportive of your interest in your biological parents?
I didn't go looking until both of them had passed away.
Oh, okay.
I didn't really feel... It's a strange thing, and I'm sure that a lot of listeners probably who are adopted too may feel that. You tend to feel this ambivalence that you can't really go and do something. It's not like you want to swap people.
Right.
And obviously your adoptive parents have cherished you, loved you for all those years, and it somehow seems a bit of a disservice to go off and say, well, I'm going to go and find this other set of parents. When they can no longer do that and you only have the memory of them that you cherish, then I think is the time to go and do that. But, you know, all people are different.
I am adopted too, and sometimes I get the feeling that my father, who's raised me, is curious about my biological mother and kind of wishes I would go try to find her, but I haven't yet.
Oh, that's good. I mean, I think that's absolutely wonderful. My adoptive parents weren't really particularly inclined to ever hear any things I was trying to say about who were my real parents or anything. Nobody really wanted to engage me in that conversation, and certainly no one was kind of pushing me to do that. So if things are free enough these days where parents can turn around to their children and say, hey, why don't you do this? I think that's absolutely great.
You are playing with the Selector, a version of the Selector again now, about to do a tour of the U.S., and you played Coachella this summer and had an incredibly well-received, very enthusiastically adored performance at Coachella. Is it fun to keep hitting the stage, and what brings you back to continue performing your music?
It is absolute fun these days. It's, you get to a certain age and you think, well, I just have to take every moment and get the fullest amount out of it, because you never know what's going to happen to you and you never know when it may stop. Myself and Gaps Hendrickson, the other lead singer in the band, we've known each other for so many years now. I mean, it's just like slipping into a good, comfortable pair of shoes to kind of be on stage, you know, and we both know how each other, are going to perform and things. And the bunch of musicians we have with us now, some people I've been with for over 20 years, the drummer, some people I've been with for 3 years because we've added horns as well now. But it really is a tight unit, and we've really honed it over the past 3 years and really have toured pretty much, most of Europe. We've been to Australia. We went to America in April, and we're coming back again. So we can now say that we're doing coast to coast after September and anywhere else that wants us, we want to go.
Are audiences different depending on what continent, what nation you're on or in?
I think they're all pretty much, in essence, the same, because this kind of music, what we do, which I call two-tone music, a lot of people call it ska, which it is, but we change the parameters of ska a little and maybe kind of up the beat of it as well. But I feel that if people are into this kind of music, they are into a way of looking at the world and a way of thinking and are ready to embrace other cultures and people of another color or another faith or whatever. And that comes then with quite a good joyousness, I think, whenever we perform. If you're playing to people who want to celebrate our differences, as opposed to flagging them up as something which is this huge problem, it's a completely different experience, and it is that I love so much. I mean, something that actually spreads harmony and talks about what's going on in society, and there are plenty of things there, I think, that are food for thought these days.
Pauline Black, it has been awesome to talk with you today. Thank you again for joining us.
Thank you very much, Sarah. Really great.
Pauline Black is the lead singer of The Selector. To keep track of the band, visit theselector.net, and Pauline is on Twitter at Pauline Black. I'm Sarah LaDuke, and you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.